High in the mist-shrouded peaks of Germany's Harz Mountains, legends whisper of a creature that stalks the snow, white as death and twice as merciless. It comes when the moon is full, when the forest holds its breath, when man's cruelty calls something darker from the wild. Tonight, we unravel one of the chilling gems of Gothic fiction. This is The White Wolf of the Harz Mountains by Captain Frederick Marryat, a short story originally published as part of his legendary novel The Phantom Ship, about the Flying Dutchman. Welcome to The Devil's Vault. Please join me as I wander through The Devil's Vault, where I keep my favorite horror stories. My name is Blake Milton, author of the Gothic novel Séance. In this podcast, I will read you a classic horror story on the last day of every month. It's midnight, time for Frederick Marryat's The White Wolf of the Harz Mountains. They had no difficulty in steering their course. The islands by day and the clear stars by night were their compass. It is true that they did not follow the more direct track, but they followed the more secure, working up through the smooth waters and gaining to the northward more than to the west. Many times were they chased by the Malay proas which infested the islands, but the swiftness of their little pirogue was their security. Indeed, the chase was, generally speaking, abandoned as soon as the smallness of the vessel was made out by the pirates, who expected that little or no booty was to be gained. That Amina and Philip's mission was the constant theme of their discourse may easily be imagined. One morning, as they were sailing between the isles with less wind than usual, Philip observed, "Krantz, you said that there were events in your own life, or connected with it, which would corroborate the mysterious tale I confided to you. Will you now tell me to what you referred?"
"Certainly," replied Krantz. "I have often thought of doing so, but one circumstance or another has hitherto prevented me. This is, however, a fitting opportunity. Prepare, therefore, to listen to a strange story, quite as strange, perhaps, as your own. I take it for granted that you have heard people speak of the Harz Mountains," observed Krantz.
"I have never heard people speak of them that I can recollect," replied Philip, "but I have read of them in some book and of the strange things which have occurred there."
"It is indeed a wild region," rejoined Krantz, "and many strange tales are told of it, but strange as they are, I have good reason for believing them to be true. I have told you, Philip, that I fully believe in your communion with the other world, that I credit the history of your father and the lawfulness of your mission, for that we are surrounded, impelled, and worked upon by beings different in their nature from ourselves. I have had full evidence, as you will acknowledge, when I state what has occurred in my own family. Why such malevolent beings, as I am about to speak of, should be permitted to interfere with us and punish, I may say, comparatively unoffending mortals, is beyond my comprehension, but that they are so permitted is most certain. The great principle of all evil fulfills his work of evil. Why, then, not the other minor spirits of the same class?" inquired Philip. "What matters it to us whether we are tried by and have to suffer from the enmity of our fellow mortals, or whether we are persecuted by beings more powerful and more malevolent than ourselves. We know that we have to work out our salvation, and that we shall be judged according to our strength. If then there be evil spirits who delight to oppress man, there surely must be, as Amine asserts, good spirits whose delight is to do him service. Whether then we have to struggle against our passions only, or whether we have to struggle not only against our passions, but also the dire influence of unseen enemies, we ever struggle with the same odds in our favor, as the good are stronger than the evil which we combat. In either case, we are on the vantage ground, whether, as in the first, we fight the good cause single-handed, or as in the second, although opposed, we have the host of heaven ranged on our side. Thus are the scales of divine justice evenly balanced, and man is still a free agent, as his own virtuous or vicious propensities must ever decide whether he shall gain or lose the victory. Most true, replied Krantz. And now to my history. My father was not born or originally a resident in the Harz Mountains. He was the serf of an Hungarian nobleman of great possessions in Transylvania. But, although a serf, he was not by any means a poor or illiterate man. In fact, he was rich, and his intelligence and respectability were such that he had been raised by his lord to the stewardship. But, whoever may happen to be born a serf must he remain, even though he become a wealthy man. Such was the condition of my father. My father had been married for about 5 years, and by his marriage had 3 children, my eldest brother Caesar, myself, Herman, and a sister named Marcella. You know, Philip, that Latin is still the language spoken in that country, and that will account for our high-sounding names. My mother was a very beautiful woman, unfortunately more beautiful than virtuous. She was seen and admired by the Lord of the soil. My father was sent away upon some mission, and during his absence, my mother, flattered by the attentions and won by the assiduities of this nobleman, yielded to his wishes. It so happened that my father returned very unexpectedly and discovered the intrigue. The evidence of my mother's shame was positive. He surprised her in the company of a seducer. Carried away by the impetuosity of his feelings, he watched the opportunity of a meeting taking place between them and murdered both his wife and her seducer. Conscious that as a serf, not even the provocation which he had received would be allowed as a justification of his conduct, he hastily collected together what money he could lay his hands upon, and, as we were then in the depth of winter, he put his horses to the sleigh, and taking his children with him, he set off in the middle of the night and was far away before the tragical circumstance had transpired. Aware that he would be pursued, and that he had no chance of escape if he remained in any portion of his native country, in which the authorities could lay hold of him, he continued his flight without intermission until he had buried himself in the intricacies and seclusion of the Harz Mountains. Of course, all that I have now told you, I learned afterwards. My oldest recollections are knit to a rude yet comfortable cottage in which I lived with my father, brother, and sister. It was on the confines of one of those vast forests which cover the northern part of Germany. Around it were a few acres of ground, which, during the summer months, my father cultivated, and which, though they yielded a doubtful harvest, were sufficient for our support. In the winter, we remained much indoors, for, as my father followed the chase, we were left alone, and the wolves, during that season, incessantly prowled about. My father had purchased the cottage and land about it of one of the rude foresters, who gain their livelihood partly by hunting and partly by burning charcoal for the purpose of smelting the ore from the neighboring mines. It was distant about 2 miles from any other habitation. I can call to mind the whole landscape now, the tall pines which rose up on the mountain above us and the wide expanse of forest beneath, on the topmost boughs and heads of whose trees we looked down from our cottage as the mountain below us rapidly descended into the distant valley. In summertime, the prospect was beautiful, but during the severe winter, a more desolate scene could not well be imagined. I said that in the winter, my father occupied himself with the chase. Every day he left us, and often would he lock the door that we might not leave the cottage. He had no one to assist him or to take care of us. Indeed, it was not easy to find a female servant who would live in such a solitude. But, could he have found one, my father would not have received her, for he had imbibed a horror of the sex, as the difference of his conduct towards us, his two boys, and my poor little sister Marcella evidently proved. You may suppose we were sadly neglected. Indeed, we suffered much, for my father, fearful that we might come to some harm, would not allow us fuel when he left the cottage, and we were obliged, therefore, to creep under the heaps of bear skins and there to keep ourselves as warm as we could until he returned in the evening, when a blazing fire was our delight. That my father chose this restless sort of life may appear strange, but the fact was that he could not remain quiet, whether from remorse for having committed murder, or from the misery consequent on his change of situation, or from both combined. He was never happy unless he was in a state of activity. Children, however, when left much to themselves, acquire a thoughtfulness not common to their age. So it was with us, and during the short cold days of winter, we would sit silent, longing for the happy hours when the snow would melt and the leaves burst out and the birds begin their songs, and when we should again be set at liberty. Such was our peculiar and savage sort of life until my brother Caesar was 9, myself 7, and my sister 5 years old, when the circumstances occurred on which is based the extraordinary narrative which I am about to relate. One evening my father returned home rather later than usual. He had been unsuccessful, and, as the weather was very severe and many feet of snow were upon the ground, he was not only very cold, but in a very bad humor. He had brought in wood, and we were all three of us gladly assisting each other in blowing on the embers to create the blaze, when he caught poor little Marcella by the arm and threw her aside. The child fell, struck her mouth, and bled very much. My brother ran to raise her up. Accustomed to ill usage and afraid of my father, she did not dare to cry, but looked up in his face very piteously. My father drew his stool nearer to the hearth, muttered something in abuse of women, and busied himself with the fire, which both my brother and I had deserted when our sister was so unkindly treated. A cheerful blaze was soon the result of his exertions, but we did not, as usual, crowd round it. Marcella, still bleeding, retired to a corner, and my brother and I took our seats beside her, while my father hung over the fire gloomily and alone. Such had been our position for about half an hour, when the howl of a wolf close under the window of the cottage fell on our ears. My father started up and seized his gun. The howl was repeated. He examined the priming and then hastily left the cottage, shutting the door after him. We all waited, anxiously listening, for we thought that if he succeeded in shooting the wolf, he would return in a better humor. And although he was harsh to all of us, and particularly so to our little sister, still we loved our father and loved to see him cheerful and happy, for what else had we to look up to? And I may here observe that perhaps There never were three children who were fonder of each other. We did not, like other children, fight and dispute together. And if by chance any disagreement did arise between my elder brother and me, little Marcella would run to us and, kissing us both, seal, through her entreaties, the peace between us. Marcella was a lovely, amiable child. I can recall her beautiful features even now. Alas, poor little Marcella. She is dead then? Observed Philip. Dead, yes, dead. But how did she die? But I must not anticipate, Philip. Let me tell my story. We waited for some time, but the report of the gun did not reach us, and my elder brother then said, "Our father has followed the wolf and will not be back for some time. Marcella, let us wash the blood from your mouth, and then we will leave this corner and go to the fire and warm ourselves." We did so and remained there until near midnight, every minute wondering, as it grew later, why our father did not return. We had no idea that he was in any danger, but we thought that he must have chased the wolf for a very long time. "I will look out and see if father is coming," said my brother Caesar, going to the door. "Take care," said Marcella. "The wolves must be about now, and we cannot kill them, brother." My brother opened the door very cautiously, and but a few inches, he peeped out. "I see nothing," said he after a time, and once more he joined us at the fire. "We have had no supper," said I, for my father usually cooked the meat as soon as he came home, and during his absence we had nothing but the fragments of the preceding day. "And if our father comes home after his hunt, Caesar," said Marcella, "he will be pleased to have some supper. Let us cook it for him and for ourselves." Caesar climbed upon the stool and reached down some meat. I forget now whether it was venison or bear's meat, but we cut off the usual quantity and proceeded to dress it as we used to do under our father's superintendence. We were all busied putting it into the platters before the fire to await his coming when we heard the sound of a horn. We listened. There was a noise outside, and a minute afterwards my father entered, ushering in a young female and a large dark man in a hunter's dress. Perhaps I had better now relate what was only known to me many years afterwards. When my father had left the cottage, he perceived a large white wolf about 30 yards from him. As soon as the animal saw my father, it retreated slowly, growling and snarling. My father followed. The animal did not run, but always kept at some distance, and my father did not like to fire until he was pretty certain that his ball would take effect. Thus they went on for some time, the wolf now leaving my father far behind and then stopping and snarling defiance at him, and then again, on his approach, setting off at speed. Anxious to shoot the animal, for the white wolf is very rare, my father continued the pursuit for several hours, during which he continually ascended the mountain. You must know, Philip, that there are peculiar spots on those mountains which are supposed, and, as my story will prove, truly supposed, to be inhabited by the evil influences. They are well known to the huntsmen, who invariably avoid them. Now, one of these spots, an open space in the pine forests above us, had been pointed out to my father as dangerous on that account. But whether he disbelieved these wild stories, or whether, in his eager pursuit of the chase, he disregarded them, I know not. Certain, however, it is that he was decoyed by the white wolf to this open space when the animal appeared to slacken her speed. My father approached, came close up to her, raised his gun to his shoulder, and was about to fire, when the wolf suddenly disappeared. He thought that the snow on the ground must have dazzled his sight, and he let down his gun to look for the beast, but she was gone. How she could have escaped over the clearance without his seeing her was beyond his comprehension. Mortified at the ill success of his chase, He was about to retrace his steps when he heard the distant sound of a horn. Astonishment at such a sound, at such an hour, in such a wilderness, made him forget for the moment his disappointment, and he remained riveted to the spot. In a minute, the horn was blown a second time, and at no great distance. My father stood still and listened. A third time it was blown. I forget the term used to express it, but it was the signal which, my father well knew, implied that the party was lost in the woods. In a few minutes more, my father beheld a man on horseback with a female seated on the crupper enter the cleared space and ride up to him. At first, my father called to mind the strange stories which he had heard of the supernatural beings who were said to frequent these mountains. But the nearer approach of the party satisfied him that they were mortals like himself. As soon as they came up to him, the man who guided the horse accosted him. "Friend Hunter, you are out late. The better fortune for us. We have ridden far and are in fear of our lives, which are eagerly sought after. These mountains have enabled us to elude our pursuers. But if we find not shelter and refreshment, that will avail us little, as we must perish from hunger and the inclemency of the night. My daughter, who rides behind me, is now more dead than alive. Say, can you assist us in our difficulty?" "My cottage is some few miles distant," replied my father, "but I have little to offer you besides a shelter from the weather. To the little I have, you are welcome. May I ask whence you come?" "Yes, friend, it is no secret now. We have escaped from Transylvania, where my daughter's honor and my life were equally in jeopardy." This information was quite enough to raise an interest in my father's heart. He remembered his own escape. He remembered the loss of his wife's honor and the tragedy by which it was wound up. He immediately and warmly offered all the assistance which he could afford them. "There is no time to be lost then, good sir," observed the horseman. "My daughter is chilled with the frost and cannot hold out much longer against the severity of the weather." "Follow me," replied my father, leading the way towards his home. "I was lured away in pursuit of a large white wolf," observed my father. "It came to the very window of my hut, or I should not have been out at this time of night." "The creature passed by us just as we came out of the wood," said the female in a silvery tone. "I was nearly discharging my piece at it," observed the hunter. "But since it did us such good service, I am glad that I allowed it to escape." In about an hour and a half, during which my father walked at a rapid pace, the party arrived at the cottage and, as I said before, came in. "We are in good time, apparently," observed the dark hunter, catching the smell of the roasted meat as he walked to the fire and surveyed my brother and sister and myself. "You have young cooks here, mine here." "I am glad that we shall not have to wait," replied my father. "Come, mistress, seat yourself by the fire. You require warmth after your cold ride." "And where can I put up my horse, mine here?" observed the huntsman. "I will take care of him," replied my father, going out of the cottage door. "The female must, however, be particularly described. She was young and apparently 20 years of age. She was dressed in a traveling dress, deeply bordered with white fur, and wore a cap of white ermine on her head. Her features were very beautiful, at least I thought so, and so my father has since declared. Her hair was flaxen, glossy and shining, and bright as a mirror, and her mouth, although somewhat large when it was open, showed the most brilliant teeth I have ever beheld. But there was something about her eyes, bright as they were, which made us children afraid. They were so restless so furtive. I could not at that time tell why, but I felt as if there was cruelty in her eye. And when she beckoned us to come to her, we approached her with fear and trembling. Still, she was beautiful, very beautiful. She spoke kindly to my brother and myself, patted our heads, and caressed us. But Marcella would not come near her. On the contrary, she slunk away and hid herself in the bed and would not wait for the supper, which half an hour before she had been so anxious for. My father, having put the horse into a close shed, soon returned, and supper was placed upon the table. When it was over, my father requested that the young lady would take possession of his bed, and he would remain at the fire and sit up with her father. After some hesitation on her part, this arrangement was agreed to, and I and my brother crept into the other bed with Marcella, for we had as yet always slept together. But we could not sleep. There was something so unusual, not only in seeing strange people, but in having those people sleep at the cottage, that we were bewildered. As for poor little Marcella, she was quiet, but I perceived that she trembled during the whole night, and sometimes I thought that she was checking a sob. My father had brought out some spirits, which he rarely used, and he and the strange hunter remained drinking and talking before the fire. Our ears were ready to catch the slightest whisper, so much was our curiosity excited. "You said you came from Transylvania?" observed my father. "Even so, mynheer," replied the hunter. "I was a serf to the noble house of..." My master would insist upon my surrendering up my fair girl to his wishes. It ended in my giving him a few inches of my hunting knife. "We are countrymen and brothers in misfortune," replied my father, taking the huntsman's hand and pressing it warmly. "Indeed, are you then from that country?" "Yes, and I too have fled for my life, but mine is a melancholy tale." "Your name?" inquired the hunter. "Krantz." "What? Krantz of..." "I have heard your tale. You need not renew your grief by repeating it now. Welcome, most welcome, mine here. And, I may say, my worthy kinsman, I am your second cousin, Wilfred of Barnsdorf," cried the hunter, rising up and embracing my father. They filled their horn mugs to the brim and drank to one another after the German fashion. The conversation was then carried on in a low tone. All that we could collect from it was that our new relative and his daughter were to take up their abode in our cottage, at least for the present. In about an hour, they both fell back in their chairs and appeared to sleep. "Marcella, dear, did you hear?" said my brother in a low tone. "Yes," replied Marcella in a whisper. "I heard all." "Oh, brother, I cannot bear to look upon that woman. I feel so frightened." My brother made no reply, and shortly afterwards, we were all three fast asleep. When we awoke the next morning, we found that the hunter's daughter had risen before us. I thought she looked more beautiful than ever. She came up to little Marcella and caressed her. The child burst into tears and sobbed as if her heart would break. But not to detain you with too long a story, the huntsman and his daughter were accommodated in the cottage. My father and he went out hunting daily, leaving Christina with us. She performed all the household duties, was very kind to us children, and gradually the dislike even of little Marcella wore away. But a great change took place in my father. He appeared to have conquered his aversion to the sex and was most attentive to Christina. Often, after her father and we were in bed, would he sit up with her, conversing in a low tone by the fire. I ought to have mentioned that my father and the huntsman Wilfred slept in another portion of the cottage, and that the bed which he formerly occupied and which was in the same room as ours, had been given up to the use of Christina. These visitors had been about 3 weeks at the cottage when, one night, after we children had been sent to bed, a consultation was held. My father had asked Christina in marriage and had obtained both her own consent and that of Wilfred. After this, a conversation took place, which was, as nearly as I can recollect, as follows. You may take my child, Mynheer Krantz, and my blessing with her, and I shall then leave you and seek some other habitation. It matters little where. Why not remain here, Wilfred? No, no. I am called elsewhere. Let that suffice, and ask no more questions. You have my child. I thank you for her, and will duly value her, but there is one difficulty. I know what you would say. There is no priest here in this wild country. True, neither is there any law to bind. Still, must some ceremony pass between you to satisfy a father. Will you consent to marry her after my fashion? If so, I will marry you directly. I will, replied my father. Then take her by the hand. Now, Mynheer, swear. I swear, repeated my father, by all the spirits of the Hartz Mountains. Nay, why not by heaven? Interrupted my father. Because it is not my humor, rejoined Wilfred, if I prefer that oath, less binding perhaps, than another, surely you will not thwart me. Well, be it so then, have your humor. Will you make me swear by that in which I do not believe? Yet many do so, who in outward appearance are Christians, rejoined Wilfred. Say, will you be married, or shall I take my daughter away with me? Proceed, replied my father impatiently. I swear by all the spirits of the Hartz Mountains, by all their power for good or for evil, that I take Christina for my wedded wife, that I will ever protect her, cherish her, and love her, that my hand shall never be raised against her to harm her. My father repeated the words after Wilfred. And if I fail in this, my vow, may all the vengeance of the spirits fall upon me and upon my children. May they perish by the vulture, by the wolf, or other beasts of the forest. May their flesh be torn from their limbs and their bones blanch in the wilderness. All this I swear. My father hesitated as he repeated the last words. Little Marcella could not restrain herself, and as my father repeated the last sentence, she burst into tears. This sudden interruption appeared to discompose the party, particularly my father. He spoke harshly to the child, who controlled her sobs, burying her face under the bedclothes. Such was the second marriage of my father. The next morning, the hunter Wilfred mounted his horse and rode away. My father resumed his bed, which was in the same room as ours, and things went on much as before the marriage, except that our new mother-in-law did not show any kindness towards us. Indeed, during my father's absence, she would often beat us, particularly little Marcella, and her eyes would flash fire as she looked eagerly upon the fair and lovely child. One night, my sister awoke me and my brother. What is the matter? Said Caesar. She has gone out, whispered Marcella. Gone out? Yes, gone out at the door in her night clothes, replied the child. I saw her get out of bed, look at my father to see if he slept, and then she went out at the door. What could induce her to leave her bed and all undressed to go out in such bitter wintry weather, with the snow deep on the ground, was to us incomprehensible. We lay awake, and in about an hour, we heard the growl of a wolf close under the window. There is a wolf, Thud, said Caesar. She will be torn to pieces. Oh no, cried Marcella. In a few minutes afterwards, our mother-in-law appeared. She was in her nightdress, as Marcella had stated. She let down the latch of the door, so as to make no noise, went to a pail of water and washed her face and hands, and then slipped into the bed where my father lay. We all three trembled, we hardly knew why, but we resolved to watch the next night. We did so, and not only on the ensuing night, but on many others, and always at about the same hour, would our mother-in-law rise from her bed and leave the cottage, and after she was gone, we invariably heard the growl of a wolf under our window, and always saw her, on her return, wash herself before she retired to bed. We observed also that she seldom sat down to meals, and that when she did, she appeared to eat with dislike. But when the meat was taken down to be prepared for dinner, she would often furtively put a raw piece into her mouth. My brother Caesar was a courageous boy. He did not like to speak to my father until he knew more. He resolved that he would follow her out and ascertain what she did. Marcella and I endeavored to dissuade him from this project, but he would not be controlled, and the very next night he lay down in his clothes, and as soon as our mother-in-law had left the cottage, he jumped up, took down my father's gun, and followed her. You may imagine in what a state of suspense Marcella and I remained during his absence. After a few minutes, we heard the report of a gun. It did not awaken my father, and we lay trembling with anxiety. In a minute afterwards, we saw our mother-in-law enter the cottage. Her dress was bloody. I put my hand to Marcella's mouth to prevent her crying out, although I was myself in great alarm. Our mother-in-law approached my father's bed, looked to see if he was asleep, and then went to the chimney and blew up the embers into a blaze. "Who is there?" said my father, waking up. "Lie still, dearest," replied my mother-in-law. "It is only me. I have lighted the fire to warm some water. I am not quite well." My father turned round and was soon asleep, but we watched our mother-in-law. She changed her linen and threw the garments she had worn into the fire, and we then perceived that her right leg was bleeding profusely, as if from a gunshot wound. She bandaged it up, and then dressing herself, remained before the fire until the break of day. Poor little Marcella. Her heart beat quick as she pressed me to her side. So indeed did mine. Where was our brother Caesar? How did my mother-in-law receive the wound, unless from his gun? At last my father rose, and then, for the first time I spoke, saying, "Father, where is my brother Caesar?" "Your brother!" exclaimed he. "Why, where can he be?" "Merciful heaven," I thought as I lay very restless last night, observed our mother-in-law, "that I heard somebody open the latch of the door. And dear me, husband, what has become of your gun?" My father cast his eyes up above the chimney and perceived that his gun was missing. For a moment he looked perplexed. Then, seizing a broad axe, he went out of the cottage without saying another word. He did not remain away from us long. In a few minutes he returned, bearing in his arms the mangled body of my poor brother. He laid it down and covered up his face. My mother-in-law rose up and looked at the body, while Marcella and I threw ourselves by its side, wailing and sobbing bitterly. "Go to bed again, children," said she sharply. "Husband," continued she, "your boy must have taken the gun down to shoot a wolf, and the animal has been too powerful for him. Poor boy, he has paid dearly for his rashness." My father made no reply. I wished to speak, to tell all, but Marcella, who perceived my intention, held me by the arm and looked at me so imploringly that I desisted. My father, therefore, was left in his error, but Marcella and I, although we could not comprehend it, were conscious that our mother-in-law was in some way connected with my brother's death. That day, my father went out and dug a grave, And when he laid the body in the earth, he piled up stones over it so that the wolves should not be able to dig it up. The shock of this catastrophe was to my poor father very severe. For several days, he never went to the chase, although at times he would utter bitter anathemas and vengeance against the wolves. But during this time of mourning, on his part, my mother-in-law's nocturnal wanderings continued with the same regularity as before. At last, my father took down his gun to repair to the forest, but he soon returned and appeared much annoyed. Would you believe it, Christina, that the wolves, perdition to the whole race, have actually contrived to dig up the body of my poor boy, and now there is nothing left of him but his bones? Indeed, replied my mother-in-law. Marcella looked at me, and I saw in her intelligent eye all she would have uttered. A wolf growls under our window every night, father, said I. Aye, indeed. Why did you not tell me, boy? Wake me the next time you hear it. I saw my mother-in-law turn away, her eyes flashed fire, and she gnashed her teeth. My father went out again and covered up with a larger pile of stones the little remnants of my poor brother which the wolves had spared. Such was the first act of the tragedy. The spring now came on, the snow disappeared, and we were permitted to leave the cottage. But never would I quit for one moment my dear little sister, to whom, since the death of my brother, I was more ardently attached than ever. Indeed, I was afraid to leave her alone with my mother-in-law, who appeared to have a particular pleasure in ill-treating the child. My father was now employed upon his little farm, and I was able to render him some assistance. Marcella used to sit by us while we were at work, leaving my mother-in-law alone in the cottage. I ought to observe that, as the spring advanced, so did my mother-in-law decrease her nocturnal rambles, and that we never heard the growl of the wolf under the window after I had spoken of it to my father. One day, when my father and I were in the field, Marcella being with us, my mother-in-law came out, saying that she was going into the forest to collect some herbs my father wanted, and that Marcella must go to the cottage and watch the dinner. Marcella went, and my mother-in-law soon disappeared in the forest, taking a direction quite contrary to that in which the cottage stood, and leaving my father and I, as it were, between her and Marcella. About an hour afterwards, we were startled by shrieks from the cottage, evidently the shrieks of little Marcella. Marcella has burnt herself, father, said I, throwing down my spade. My father threw down his, and we both hastened to the cottage. Before we could gain the door, out darted a large white wolf, which fled with the utmost celerity. My father had no weapon. He rushed into the cottage, and there saw poor little Marcella expiring. Her body was dreadfully mangled, and the blood pouring from it had formed a large pool on the cottage floor. My father's first intention had been to seize his gun and pursue, but he was checked by this horrid spectacle. He knelt down by his dying child and burst into tears. Marcella could just look kindly on us for a few seconds, and then her eyes were closed in death. My father and I were still hanging over my poor sister's body when my mother-in-law came in. At the dreadful sight, she expressed much concern, but she did not appear to recoil from the sight of blood as most women do. Poor child, said she. It must have been that great white wolf which passed me just now and frightened me so. She's quite dead, Krantz. I know it, cried my father in agony. I thought my father would never recover from the effects of this second tragedy. He mourned bitterly over the body of his sweet child, and for several days would not consign it to its grave, although frequently requested by my mother-in-law to do so. At last he yielded and dug a grave for her close by that of my poor brother, and took every precaution that the wolves should not violate her remains. I was now really miserable, as I lay alone in the bed which I had formerly shared with my brother and sister. I could not help thinking that my mother-in-law was implicated in both their deaths, although I could not account for the manner. But I no longer felt afraid of her. My little heart was full of hatred and revenge. The night after my sister had been buried, as I lay awake, I perceived my mother-in-law get up and go out of the cottage. I waited some time, then dressed myself and looked out through the door, which I half opened. The moon shone bright, and I could see the spot where my brother and my sister had been buried. And what was my horror when I perceived my mother-in-law busily removing the stones from Marcella's grave. She was in her white nightdress, and the moon shone full upon her. She was digging with her hands and throwing away the stones behind her with all the ferocity of a wild beast. It was some time before I could collect my senses and decide what I should do. At last, I perceived that she had arrived at the body and raised it up to the side of the grave. I could bear it no longer. I ran to my father and awoke him. "Father, father," cried I, "dress yourself and get your gun." "What?" cried my father. "The wolves are there, are they?" He jumped out of bed, threw on his clothes, and in his anxiety did not appear to perceive the absence of his wife. As soon as he was ready, I opened the door, he went out, and I followed him. Imagine his horror when, unprepared as he was for such a sight, he beheld, as he advanced towards the grave, not a wolf, but his wife, in her nightdress, on her hands and knees, crouching by the body of my sister, and tearing off large pieces of the flesh, and devouring them with all the avidity of a wolf. She was too busy to be aware of our approach. My father dropped his gun. His hair stood on end. So did mine. He breathed heavily, and then his breath for a time stopped. I picked up the gun and put it into his hand. Suddenly, he appeared as if concentrated rage had restored him to double vigor. He leveled his piece, fired, and with a loud shriek, down fell the wretch whom he had fostered in his bosom. "God of heaven!" cried my father, sinking down upon the earth in a swoon as soon as he had discharged his gun. I remained some time by his side before he recovered. "Where am I?" said he. "What has happened?" "Oh, yes, yes, I recollect now. Heaven forgive me." He rose and we walked up to the grave. What again was our astonishment and horror to find that instead of the dead body of my mother-in-law, as we expected, there was lying over the remains of my poor sister, a large white wolf. "The white wolf!" exclaimed my father. "The white wolf which decoyed me into the forest. I see it all now. I have dealt with the spirits of the Harz Mountains." For some time my father remained in silence and deep thought. He then carefully lifted up the body of my sister, replaced it in the grave, and covered it over as before, having struck the head of the dead animal with the heel of his boot and raving like a madman. He walked back to the cottage, shut the door, and threw himself on the bed. I did the same, for I was in a stupor of amazement. Early in the morning, we were both roused by a loud knocking at the door, and in rushed the hunter Wilfred. "My daughter! Man, my daughter! Where is my daughter?" cried he in a rage. "Where the wretch, the fiend, should be, I trust," replied my father, starting up and displaying equal choler. "Where she should be, in hell. Leave this cottage, or you may fare worse," replied the hunter. "Would you harm a potent spirit of the Harz Mountains? Poor mortal, who must needs wed a werewolf. Out, demon, I defy thee and thy power. yet shall you feel it. Remember your oath, your solemn oath, never to raise your hand against her, to harm her. I made no compact with evil spirits. You did, and if you failed in your vow, you were to meet the vengeance of the spirits. Your children were to perish by the vulture, the wolf. Out, out, demon! My father, frantic with rage, seized his axe and raised it over Wilfred's head to strike. All this I swear, continued the huntsman mockingly. The axe descended, but it passed through the form of the hunter, and my father lost his balance and fell heavily on the floor. Mortal, said the hunter, striding over my father's body, we have power over those only who have committed murder. You have been guilty of a double murder. You shall pay the penalty attached to your marriage vow. Two of your children are gone. The third is yet to follow, and follow them he will, for your oath is registered. Go. It were kindness to kill thee. Your punishment is that you live. With these words, the spirit disappeared. My father rose from the floor, embraced me tenderly, and knelt down in prayer. The next morning, he quitted the cottage forever. He took me with him and bent his steps to Holland, where we safely arrived. He had some little money with him, but he had not been many days in Amsterdam before he was seized with a brain fever and died raving mad. I was put into the asylum and afterwards was sent to sea before the mast. You now know all my history. The question is whether I am to pay the penalty of my father's oath. I am myself perfectly convinced that, in some way or another, I shall. On the 22nd day, the high land of the south of Sumatra was in view. As there were no vessels in sight, they resolved to keep their course through the straits and run for Pulo Penang, which they expected, as their vessel laid so close to the wind, to reach in 7 or 8 days. By constant exposure, Philip and Krantz were now so bronzed that with their long beards and Mussulman dresses, they might easily have passed off for natives. They had steered during the whole of the days exposed to a burning sun. They had lain down and slept in the dew of night, but their health had not suffered. But for several days, since he had confided the history of his family to Philip, Krantz had become silent and melancholy. His usual flow of spirits had vanished, and Philip had often questioned him as to the cause. As they entered the straits, Philip talked of what they should do upon their arrival at Goa. When Krantz gravely replied, "For some days, Philip, I have had a presentiment that I shall never see that city." "You are out of health, Krantz," replied Philip. "No, I am in sound health, body and mind. I have endeavored to shake off the presentiment, but in vain. There is a warning voice that continually tells me that I shall not be long with you. Philip, will you oblige me by making me content on one point? I have gold about my person which may be useful to you. Oblige me by taking it and securing it on your own." "What nonsense, Krantz." "It is no nonsense, Philip. Have you not had your warnings? Why should I not have mine? You know that I have little fear in my composition, and that I care not about death, but I feel the presentiment which I speak of more strongly every hour. It is some kind spirit who would warn me to prepare for another world. Be it so, I have lived long enough in this world to leave it without regret, although to part with you and Amina, the only two now dear to me, is painful, I acknowledge." "May not this arise from overexertion and fatigue, Krantz? Consider how much excitement you have labored under within these last 4 months. Is not that enough to create a corresponding depression? Depend upon it, my dear friend, such is the fact." "I wish it were, but I feel otherwise, and there is a feeling of gladness connected with the idea that I am to leave this world, arising from another presentiment, which equally occupies my mind." Which is? I hardly can tell you, but Amina and you are connected with it. In my dreams, I have seen you meet again, but it has appeared to me as if a portion of your trial was purposely shut from my sight in dark clouds, and I have asked, may not I see what is there concealed? And an invisible has answered, no. 'Twould make you wretched. Before these trials take place, you will be summoned away. And then I have thanked heaven and felt resigned. These are the imaginings of a disturbed brain, Krantz. That I am destined to suffering may be true, but why Amine should suffer, or why you, young in full health and vigor, should not pass your days in peace and live to a good old age. There is no cause for believing. You will be better tomorrow. Perhaps so, replied Krantz. But still, you must yield to my whim and take the gold. If I am wrong, and we do arrive safe, you know, Philip, you can let me have it back, observed Krantz with a faint smile. But you forget, our water is nearly out, and we must look out for a rill on the coast to obtain a fresh supply. I was thinking of that when you commenced this unwelcome topic. We had better look out for the water before dark, and as soon as we have replenished our jars, we will make sail again. At the time that this conversation took place, they were on the eastern side of the strait, about 40 miles to the northward. The interior of the coast was rocky and mountainous, but it slowly descended to lowland of alternate forest and jungles, which continued to the beach. The country appeared to be uninhabited. Keeping close into the shore, they discovered, after 2 hours' run, a fresh stream which burst in a cascade from the mountains and swept its devious course through the jungle until it poured its tribute into the waters of the strait. They ran close into the mouth of the stream, lowered the sails, and pulled the Paroquois against the current until they had advanced far enough to assure them that the water was quite fresh. The jars were soon filled, and they were again thinking of pushing off, when, enticed by the beauty of the spot, the coolness of the fresh water, and wearied with their long confinement on board of the Paroquois, they proposed to bathe, a luxury hardly to be appreciated by those who have not been in a similar situation. They threw off their musselman dresses and plunged into the stream, where they remained for some time. Krantz was the first to get out. He complained of feeling chilled, and he walked on to the banks where their clothes had been laid. Philip also approached nearer to the beach, intending to follow him. And now, Philip, said Krantz, this will be a good opportunity for me to give you the money. I will open my sash and pour it out, and you can put it into your own before you put it on. Philip was standing in the water, which was about level with his waist. Well, Krantz, said he, I suppose if it must be so, it must. But it appears to me an idea so ridiculous. However, you shall have your own way. Philip quitted the run and sat down by Krantz, who was already busy in shaking the doubloons out of the folds of his sash. At last he said, I believe, Philip, you have got them all now. I feel satisfied. What danger there can be to you, which I am not equally exposed to, I cannot conceive, replied Philip. However, hardly had he said these words when there was a tremendous roar, a rush like a mighty wind through the air, a blow which threw him on his back, a loud cry, and a contention. Philip recovered himself and perceived the naked form of Krantz carried off with the speed of an arrow by an enormous tiger through the jungle. He watched with distended eyeballs. In a few seconds, the animal and Krantz had disappeared. God of heaven, would that thou hadst spared me this, cried Philip, throwing himself down in agony on his face. Oh, Krantz, my friend, my brother, too sure was your presentiment. Merciful God, have pity, but thy will be done. And Philip burst into a flood of tears, For more than an hour did he remain fixed upon the spot, careless and indifferent to the danger by which he was surrounded. At last, somewhat recovered, he rose, dressed himself, and then again sat down, his eyes fixed upon the clothes of Krantz and the gold which still lay on the sand. He would give me that gold. He foretold his doom. Yes, yes, it was his destiny, and it has been fulfilled. His bones will bleach in the wilderness, and the spirit hunter and his wolfish daughter are avenged. The shades of evening now set in, and the low growling of the beasts of the forest recalled Philip to a sense of his own danger. He thought of Amin, and hastily making the clothes of Krantz and the doubloons into a package, he stepped into the Perroquet, with difficulty shoved it off, and with a melancholy heart and in silence hoisted the sail and pursued his course. You have been listening to The White Wolf of the Harz Mountains by Frederick Marriott. As the morning approaches, the Devil's Vault is closing its doors. For more information about this podcast and my gothic thrillers, please visit blakemilton.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe and feel free to get in touch. Perhaps you have a suggestion or a story you'd like to hear. Anything is possible. I'm Blake Milton. Thank you for listening, and see you next month for another visit to the Devil's Vault.